After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
One of the cardinal features, one of the most important things that's been learned in this sort of second renaissance in the clinical trials has been the importance of two things that were not really understood that well in the 60s, and that is preparation and integration. By contrast, one of the things that really was discovered early on and articulated very well by Ram Dass and also by Leary was the importance of so-called set and setting. Yeah. And that has survived. That was figured out early on and it never went away, and it's been rediscovered over and over again.
Hi everyone, it's Raghu again with Mind Rolling. And I'm with a new friend, and his name is Silver Quevedo. Is that good, my pronunciation on that?
Absolutely Quevedo? Good. Yeah, terrific. Yeah, Quevedo. Yeah, Quevedo or Quevedo.
Quevedo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably Silver. Right?
No, actually, Silver is a nickname that I kind of grew up with. My full name is Silvestre in Spanish, Sylvester.
So... Listen, we got to hear a little bit about where you grew up and your antecedents, ancestors included. I think that to let us all know where you're coming from, and where you're coming from, the arc to where you are now and the way you have. So let me just say, everybody, Silver is doing a lot of amazing research around with MAPS. I think many of you know who MAPS is, around psychedelic therapy, etc. Okay, so he's deep into that, and the hearing about your antecedents and where you come from, really, you have a foot in the scientific world and in the real world.
yeah, that's a good way.
Sorry,
that's a good way to put it. So let me see if I can be concise about this, because it's a long story because I'm old.
No, that's okay. But we have more time.
I was born in Southern California, and my family is all from southwestern New Mexico, and some parts of my family are indigenous to the American Southwest. Have been there for many generations before it was part of the U.S. way back. And another part, the other part of my father's side is from the borderlands, from the area right along the Chihuahua-New Mexico border, which many people will recognize wasn't always where the border was. So a lot of the people that in my family say we never crossed the border kept crossing us. So that's where my roots are. On both sides of my family, lots of New Mexican Hispanic, as I say, from many generations past, and some more recent from the border zone area, and indigenous people, relatives, Mescalero, Apache, and Pueblo people on both sides.
Mm. Well, so, Pueblo people go, I mean, you said generations, Pueblo people go back eons, for that matter. I mean, right? Because I only know, you know, being in Taos, and I did live in New Mexico myself, in Santa Fe at one time, but spending a lot of time in Taos, because that's where we have our
right
Hanuman temple.
Yes,
from what we came back to India, from India with. So I do, you know, that that's the oldest ongoing town, community, town in America is Taos.
Right.
Of the Pueblo people.
Yes, yeah. And I've been to the ashram in Taos. Beautiful.
Place.
Yeah, wonderful community, wonderful place. Lots of history, as we've talked about, with Ram Dass and Maharaji and all of that. So it's all there. And it's wonderful that it's just right down the road, you know, from the Pueblo.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why I think that. But anyway, Pueblo people are some of the original people to the Southwest, and yeah, going back centuries and centuries. Different than other cultures and communities, they tended to be agriculturalists. They lived locally along the Rio Grande, which is the major water source. Apaches had a different culture. They were more hunter-gatherer, more itinerant, nomadic. And so different sort of cultures, but both indigenous to that area, to the southwestern U.S. And there's a lot to that in the sense that there is a kind of identity, culture, and sort of worldview that precedes the colonial period, first the Spanish colonial period, and then the American English colonial period. And people still, they remember. It's kind of amazing how that is. I mean, it's passed down through the generations and the stories, et cetera.
Really?
But yeah, and that sort of identity and worldview, et cetera, is sort of alive and well, as you know, you've been in New Mexico. And there's lots of variations within the theme. You know, we're comfortable now saying that there's more variation within groups than between groups. So it's not as if all Pueblo people are a monolith. There's a whole range. But I sort of grew up quite comfortable being in relationship to indigenous people, indigenous sort of cosmology and perspectives, as well as much more modern modernist worldviews. My parents left the New Mexico area and started traveling to Los Angeles during the Great Depression when the mines closed. My father's family worked in the mines. And they started coming to L.A. in the 30s and finally settled out there just before World War II in the late 30s. And I grew up in Los Angeles amidst a community of mostly people from New Mexico who had migrated to Southern California, but also because of where we were from, a lot of my family spoke Spanish quite well, and they were very close to Spanish-speaking people in Southern California, the majority of whom at the time, and even now, I think, are Mexican-American. And that's a broad term because it has a lot of connotations, not least of which is that, you know, what's part of Mexico now wasn't always part of Mexico and was part of the U.S. I once asked one of my grandfathers who was Pueblo, like, which country was he born in? And because he was born right on the river. And he said, I didn't like either one of them that much. What he was trying to tell me is he's from the land. He's not from a country, which they saw as sort of fictions.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the background. I went to school in California. I went to college at Berkeley. And I was there during the 60s, and it was an important period for me. I had a sort of very much an awakening of my sort of awareness of the historical moment and that it sort of mattered how you lived your life, you know, during the early civil rights era. I went on to medical school at Harvard. Enjoyed being in New England because it was really completely different than anything I do, very broadening for me. I went to work in community health centers because I wanted to work in underserved areas, and particularly in the American Southwest. I went to the University of Arizona for a while, then started a few community health centers in Colorado, New Mexico area, worked in that world for about 5 years, and then Largely, I had trained in family medicine. I didn't like being treated as a second-class citizen by hospital-type doctors and specialists. Mm. So I went back to training at Stanford in internal medicine and nephrology, did specialty training in kidney disease, and did high-tech medicine, hospital medicine for several years, was on the faculty for about 14 years at Stanford doing nephrology and teaching residents and dialysis and transplantation. But as often has happened in my career, I got sort of tired of the smallness of the mindset of the specialist, even though I liked the precision in the application of some of the technology that we had. General practice is much harder than specialty practice for lots of reasons we can talk about that. Anyway, I had an opportunity to travel in the early days of the integrative medicine movement, which I was interested in. I thought we should be doing more prevention and et cetera, et cetera. And nephrologists weren't interested. They said, that's what happens in medical clinic. We don't do that kind of thing. The usual stuff. Yeah. So I traveled for a year doing consultation work during a sabbatical with a consortium of hospitals to see whether integrated medicine models could be applied in community hospitals. And we set up an integrated medicine center at this particular hospital. And all of that led me to becoming part of the Osher Center for Integrated Medicine at UCSF, where I was a clinical director and Osher professor of integrated medicine in close to 20 years ago now. And that was a time when we were hoping that a few things. One, that we could, through integrative medicine, return to a more holistic approach to patients, sort of body, mind, and spirit. And also that we would have more of a comparative approach to medicine and to healing. That Western scientific medicine, we used to say Western scientific medicine, from an integrative medicine point of view, is a medicine, not the medicine. And we had Ayurvedic practitioners working with us and Chinese medicine practitioners, et cetera, et cetera. So it was an interesting period, good period, not an easy fit, as you might imagine, into the very traditional structure of an academic medical center. And that struggle still goes on. But in general, integrative medicine has survived and flourished in some places. I also was feeling a little bit tired of that and had another sabbatical opportunity and started to work internationally. I was asked to broker a meeting between traditional healers, because I had spent a lot of time doing that during my integrative medicine years, to broker medicine with traditional healers in Kenya, in Nairobi, and World Health Organization, WHO type doctors. They were not communicating. People were giving antiretrovirals, antiretroviral drugs, and patients were going to traditional healers who were saying that to be careful, those drugs can kill you. And in those days, actually, that was true. So there was a lot of difficulties in communication. People would often sort of put the drugs on the mantle and pray to them rather than take them, etc. So we had a very interesting time. A friend of mine, Onesmo Onomoyoi, who was also a physician but also Maasai, who I knew actually at Harvard in Boston, he and I brokered a meeting with doctors and traditional healers, and it was really one of the wildest and most interesting. Yeah. But it led to my working in Kenya for almost 8 years, representing global health at UCSF. And that was all done, but I came back to, when I was coming back to the U.S. about 2015 and not traveling anymore, I had a son who had been in the Navy for 15 years, for a decade and a half, and really had some very traumatic experiences while deployed, and had some real PTSD, and I frankly didn't really understand it very well, and I reached out to some people I knew that were working in the field, and I knew some of the people at MAPS were working on that. And make a long story short, that led to me becoming involved with the MAPS trial, which uses MDMA for the treatment of PTSD, which has been remarkably successful and we can talk about that. But as you may know, two things about PTSD. One, it's a terrible problem, much worse than people realize, as it is true, as is true for many mental health problems. But also the treatments are not very good, also true for many mental health problems. And this leads to the sort of rather fascinating explosion in interest in psychedelics as a treatment for PTSD, depression, etc., and as so-called breakthrough therapies, actually designated by the FDA for some of these conditions, because they're so different and so much more effective than conventional therapies. And that's a whole other topic. But in a nutshell, that's sort of how I got to where I'm at. In the meantime, about 50 years had passed since I graduated from medical school. So here we are, me and you.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, it's quite an arc. Well, you know, go back to the 60s. And I know there's concern on almost, I would say, most people who are involved with psychedelic research now about any kind of throwback to the 60s and the purview that we had then, which was not anything but, holy geez, this is incredible, and I'm going to take it until I get through onto the other side. As Ram Dass famously said,
right.
I kept coming down. So I went to India looking for a map where I wasn't going to come down. But I like to say that, although all of that is true around the 60s, you know, misguided stuff and, you know, we were mostly young kids, you know, and naive. So we had all of that going. Mm-hmm. So there's some truth there. But on the other hand, the ideals that came through there were real. Mm-hmm. Even if we were misguided and naive about a lot of stuff, including psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And that translates, in my mind, to what I referred to earlier, of course, jokingly, the reality. I mean, science is part of the reality as much as anything is part of the reality. But in terms of the truth, mm-hmm. that love that we were pursuing and that unity is a real, it was a worthy cause, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, well said. I mean, I once said, you know, we don't want to make the mistakes of the 60s, but I sort of rapidly, quickly added, and it's not to say that there weren't successes in the 60s. There were. I mean, we were in the midst of the civil rights movement. We were in the midst of the anti-war movement. We used to, as you say, peace and love were values that we cared seriously about. And for those who had psychedelic experiences associated with this sort of empathogenic quality that occurs with many psychedelics, that is a sort of opening of the heart and sort of more sort of pro-social behaviors, the mm-hmm. practice of loving kindness. That's, yeah, absolutely. Those values were important, are important, and remain that way. And similarly, some of the aphorisms, some of the sort of teachings that people came out with, exactly what you said, what Ram Dass used to say, you know, the trouble with getting high is you come down. And that's so much, that's as ever true now. So,
yeah.
So you know, that's a big issue in psychedelic therapies. So, okay, you know, you have these big experiences. How is it integrated? And one of the cardinal features, one of the most important things that's been learned in this sort of second renaissance in the clinical trials has been the importance of two things that were not really understood that well in the 60s, and that is preparation and integration. By contrast, one of the things that really was discovered early on and articulated very well by Ram Dass and also by Leary was the importance of so-called set and setting.
Yeah.
And that has survived. That was figured out early on, and it never went away, and it's been rediscovered over and over again. So we're comfortable saying that the psychedelic experience is really a function of three things, the medicine, both quality and dose, set and setting. Mm. And Houston Smith has said this exactly, and that the point is not just a spiritual experience or a empathogenic or heart-opening experience, but it's a spiritual life. And a life that has the practice of loving kindness within it, and that is what integration is about.
That's so great, actually. You just reminded me. God, how this fits! It's so many people, and you and I discuss this when we've been hanging out, and. You know, what happened when Ram Dass gave Neem Karoli Baba acid, huge doses,
yeah.
Right? And so, those stories are famous. Nothing yeah. happened, right? when Ram Dass came back from India the first time, he was wondering, shit, did he really take it or did he flip it behind him while I wasn't looking or something? And he came back with this doubt. So he sat down, and the first thing Neem Karoli Maharaji, we called him, said was, do you have any more of that, what do you call it? Yogi medicine. That's what he called it, yogi medicine. And Ram Dass said, yes. And he made reference, he said to Ram Dass, did I take it last time? In other words, knowing everything that was going through his head. Ram Dass said, yeah, well, anyhow, so he gave him a huge dose and he put each tab visibly on his tongue, closed his mouth and swallowed, right? One after the other, a dose that, you know, forget heroic, it was ridiculous. Nobody survived that. Anyhow, that is all fun stuff, but what you just said, just that comment, if there isn't loving kindness involved after the experience is had and that opens and blossoms in the way that loving kindness can, mm-hmm. compassion and love and so on, then what are we talking about? So what did Maharaji say about acid? It's good for, in the beginning, good for beginner. He didn't quite say beginner, but he said, you know, for one time is good. It allows you to come into the room and have darshan of Christ for a few hours. Then you have to leave. He said, and ultimately isn't a word he would ever say, but he said, better to just feed people.
That's great.
Something, you know, feed, love everyone and feed everybody. And yeah. Which is, what are we talking about? Is that has to be integrated. What does that really mean? It means you're not thinking about yourself. You start to think of others, loving kindness, empathetic joy, you know, all of those things. That's how it gets hopefully integrated into one's life following these kinds of experiences, right?
Absolutely. And nicely said. I mean, you know, it's like as Ram Dass used to say, you know, love, serve, and remember. You know, love each other, serve each other. We Native Americans say serve the value of your life is its impact on the seventh generation.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And the Tipi Church prayer is infinite gratitude to all those who have gone before us. So that's remember. Ram Dass meant more like remember God, but remember the ancestors and all of the forces of creation. Mm-hmm. That's in the broader sense.
Yeah.
Serve, you know, the infinite. So the prayer is infinite love to infinite gratitude to all those who have gone before us. Infinite love to all those who walk beside us, because we're relational, we're all connected, we're all related. That's another sort of very typical North American Western Indigenous, you know, as a Lakota say, we're all relatives and that sort of thing.
Get that, Silver? When you were young, were your relatives feeding you this information, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, and it was sort of embedded in my world, and some of it I thought was sort of old-fashioned at the time. I mean, I've come to see the wisdom as I've gotten older and studied it. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the mountains have spirits, nature has spirits, and you're connected not just to other people, but to the spirit beings of the world. You're relating from that point of view. Ontology is relational. Your beingness comes out of your relationships. And you know, in Buddhist thought, this is very similar to the idea of pratyasamutpada, like the idea of dependent origination. No entity arises only unto itself. It's always in relationship or by virtue of other things. And that's kind of a relational ontology. So yeah, but it was embedded in the language and stuff, you know. And as only as I sort of learned more broadly how to, I've come back to see the wisdom in it. But it is love, serve, and remember. And
that's so wonderful, the connectivity to that wisdom and what we were given in India. Absolutely right. The same.
And what you're saying about Maharaji and Ram Dass. Yeah, I wondered about that. I thought, wow, but you know, to a bhakti yogi, the practice of devotion, which is a practice of love, is part of your world. My feeling about Maharaji is that he knew that he lived that, and that was so powerful to understand, you know, that whole thing. And yes. That is one of the things that happens with some of these medicines like MDMA. People have an expanded sense of connection, relationship, and love. And that's it's a profound thing for many people who've never experienced it at all. But it is exactly what you say. When the drug wears off, then what? Well, that's where your practice is. All your practices become so important.
Can you give us any examples in terms of the research and the work that you've been doing with MAPS around MDMA?
So MDMA...
Individual, you know, like what has... You've seen an individual, you must talk to them before anything,
So the MDMA trial, MDMA, for people who may not know, although virtually everybody knows about MDMA now, but is methylene dioxymethamphetamine. It's a substituted amphetamine known from the pre-prohibition period as MDMA, sort of brought back into circulation by Sasha Shulgin. But even before that, MDA was quite known. It's a related compound. And it was used in the 60s and 70s to enhance therapy. It improved the relationship, the therapeutic alliance, and it was very useful in couples therapy, et cetera. Anyway, so that was all known.
I'm sorry I'm laughing because...
You remember.
I do. And the
That's good.
The context you just put it in wasn't quite where I was.
Well, yeah, we won't go into that, but it's been used in many other settings as well. Right. One corollary that is important in the research related to what we just said is that much of the toxicology literature with MDMA looks very bad, and people have seizures and all this stuff, but that's all from underground use where the quality and the purity of the MDMA was never used, and the dosing was very different.
It's all speed.
That's right.
They either didn't know what they were doing or were purposeful.
Commonly.
About using, you know, the meth, whatever, the amphetamine part.
Commonly adulterated. So one of the important findings of the trial is that MDMA given under the right circumstances at the right dose of pure MDMA, pharmaceutical quality purity, is safe. And that's a big finding. So that's one thing. The second thing is that we were treating PTSD. And in post-traumatic stress disorder, a couple of quick things. It usually happens with a big trauma, assault, near death, many examples, and I'm sure people are aware of it, much more prevalent than is what is published, because people don't talk about these traumatic experiences. Mm. How do they deal with it in their own way? A lot of times self-medicating with various substances, etc. Big, big problem. And now worse than ever because of our 15 years or 14 years of war and on and on. So what's important about PTSD patients? Number one, absolutely prerequisite is the establishment of a safe, for them, the hardest thing is finding a place that's safe and a person that they can trust, because they're hypervigilant and they're risk avoidant because they've been hurt so bad. So we work in the preparation sessions to create safety and trust in the therapeutic relationship. Why is that important with psychedelics? It's the same point. Set and setting, the mental set or the expectations, intentionality, etc., is important. But the setting is not only the physical location, but it's also the people. If you're with people that you don't trust or you can't trust or who are not there for your best interests, it can be not a good thing. And that's another important finding in the trial, but it's not just from the trial. It's what actually Ram Dass and Leary were saying very early on in the 60s when they were still at Harvard, that set and setting, the drug seems to be interacting with set and setting. So all of that has led to this trial of MDMA with PTSD, and the results are remarkable. I can't talk about the new trial that's still being published because it hasn't been released yet. Mm. But the first 100 patients have been published in Nature in 2022. And for patients, and it was two arms, it was double-blinded and placebo-controlled MDMA study. And in the placebo arm, they got therapy only, but placebo capsule they didn't know was... or was not MDMA, no one knew, so it was blinded both to the experimenters as well as the patients. And the therapy group had about a 30% on average improvement in their CAP scores, which is a PTSD measure. It's a very sort of statistical instrument that takes lots of questions and adds up to a score that grades PTSD. But the MDMA group had around a 70% improvement, anywhere from 66% to 80% was the range in their PTSD scores. Now, the big surprise was that several months later, 12 months later in the follow-up studies, the MDMA, and this was after three MDMA sessions, which are all day, spaced 1 month apart. And then 12 months late, and then no
you
more.
You mean three consecutive intake of a dose?
So one MDMA dose, a session that lasts 8 hours, and then a month later, a second MDMA dose, and then a third month, the third MDMA dose. So three MDMA doses, each day long with two therapists, usually a male and female, in the room, in very much a clinical research setting. So it's clinic rooms, not out in nature or anything like that. So, and still the intervention group, the group that got PTSD, that got MDMA after the blind was broken, had huge improvements compared to the therapy only group. Mm-hmm. So literally twice as much improvement. But the biggest surprise was 12 months later, the MDMA group, the improvements were pretty much the same. They were durable. Really? They lasted for a year. The therapy-only group tend to have had more relapses earlier. So this was a remarkable finding and led people to say, gosh, you know, it's not a pill every day. It was, you know, three sessions. This is a different model. This is medication-assisted therapy being rediscovered and away from the sort of one pill a day model that Big Pharma and psychiatry have been involved with for years. And one of the reasons that it's not so interesting to Big Pharma is you can't patent MDMA right now, and you're not giving something that you have to buy a pill a day. So dramatic stuff. It's shaking up the whole world of psychiatry. Anyway, those results led to an explosion in research and interest. Why would this happen? Why would taking something like MDMA, which some people say is not even a true psychedelic, and we can talk about the different categories because there's some interesting separations there. But why would such an experience last for 12 months? And this gave rise to this explosion in research that the tryptamines like LSD or psilocybin or DMT or the phenethylamines, which is the category of MDMA, that they have neuroplastic effects. They change the wiring. And that's what's really amazing. Now, I have to mention that it's shocking to think this way and to see these results. But we have to remember that many of these substances, MDMA is quite closely related to peyote. And as we know...
In ayahuasca, right?
Not so, in a different way to ayahuasca, differently, but not in the same chemical category. Ayahuasca has DMT and harmaline, so ayahuasca is more in the LSD psilocybin category.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, and the tryptamines are typically associated with big mystical or spiritual experiences, and that's why they're often referred to as entheogens. The peyote and MDMA, mescaline, are in the phenethylamine category. They're a little bit chemically different, still work on serotonin and dopamine and many of the receptor systems we're talking about. But often people have a relational experience of heart opening, so-called empathogenic experience. And one of the reasons that's important in PTSD is it allows people to recover their ability to trust and be in relationship, which is very hard for somebody that's been traumatized that way. Anyway, so yeah, it's sort of a quick summary of a lot of stuff, but it's been a whole explosion in interest and research, etc. And
we're go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and you know, it's why we're talking. I mean, one of the important things is to sort of revisit all this and sort of say, okay, how can we do this better? What have we learned, you know, and how can we pay attention, for example, to many of our ancestors, like Ram Dass, but also our ancestors around the world who use these substances in traditional ceremonial settings, like ayahuasca, for example, or peyote, which have been used for several thousand years, probably.
What about, that's what I was going to ask, ketamine, how does that fit in? Because back in the day, let's see, we were, what was it called? Horse tranquilizer? What do they call that? That's basically what we're talking about, right? And let me tell you that one day in India, we were meditating in the high Himalaya. This is a fun story, everybody. And with Ram Dass, we were at a Gandhi ashram right in front of us, you know, like 75 miles as the crow flies, the full range of the Himalayas in that area, with the centerpiece being this peak called Trishul, which is sacred to Shiva. It had the formation of the three-pronged peaks.
Wow.
Anyhow, we were in ecstasy, and Maharaji was, you know, about a couple hours away by car, and he was happy we were all stuck up there, not bothering him, I think. He had told, like one person had asked Maharaji, can I do this drug, which was basically it's ketamine. And Maharaji said, yeah, okay, as long as, you know, you're alone and, you know, you're up in the Himalayas, so it's cool and all that stuff. Anyhow, he got Ram Dass to do it one day. Ram Dass was going to try. I think Ram Dass probably had done it before. I can't imagine, because we all did it at that time. It just completely slams all the perceptive doors shut, and you are released. I mean, it's an extraordinary drug. Anyhow, I was in a room above the room where he was taking this dose of ketamine downstairs from me, and suddenly I start hearing this eerie kind of thing coming from a human being, noises that I really had never heard before. It was that far out, and I'm like, what the fuck? And I looked And on my floor was, there was a hole in my floor. You know, it was India, so the construction wasn't very good. Anyhow, I was able to look down and I saw Ram Dass. He was sailing around. He looked like he was the Silver Surfer and making these extraordinary sounds. And we all, so everybody heard. So we one by one went into the room. I swear to God, this is true. It sounds outrageous. And we all put a hand on, you know, his foot, his arm, his leg, whatever. Everybody had a hand. You're talking about 20 people or something, 15, 20 people. And we all, let me tell you, Silver, we were gone for about a week. I mean, just through that, of course, we had Maharaji and everything else going on, right? More to the point. But we would just, we were silent and we were like eating, and then everybody would just erupt in laughter looking at each other, like we, because we couldn't tell where each of us began and each of us ended.
Wow. Wow.
It was an extraordinary experience.
And Ram Dass's and continued for a week?
Yeah. I mean, I may be exaggerating, but I remember going to next day's eating because we'd all eat together. And I remember that feeling, like we were, you know, we had gone beyond the limitations that we were normally used to being in a human in a body.
It was wow.
Pretty, yeah. So, yeah. So ketamine seems to work too. I don't know.
It's fascinating what you just said. Yeah. So ketamine has been around for a long time. It's a whole story. There's a whole kind of rebirth of ketamine therapy occurring right now, and certainly in the media, and people have heard about it. So we can talk for a minute about it. It's a fascinating story that you gave. Ketamine's been around for a long time now, probably more than 30 years. It's used quite commonly in hospitals for conscious sedation and as an adjunct to anesthesia, because it's a so-called dissociative anesthetic. In other words, it dissociates your sort of higher cortical process from the rest of your body. So people commonly have out-of-body experiences, which is fascinating by itself. And it's a favorite in pediatrics because you can really do surgical stuff like take care of wounds and all that in patients that you can't use other drugs for. Burn victims, for example, that are young, have small trachea and a lot of laryngeal edema and tracheal edema, and it's hard to intubate them. So pediatricians will often use them to dress wounds in a child, and that sort of use something like ketamine. So it's very safe. It's well known in hospitals. And interestingly, it's kind of being rediscovered as a type. It's not a true psychedelic in the sense that tryptamine is a different chemical category, different transmitter, neurotransmitter system, but it's actually known to produce altered state experiences, including some are empathogenic at lower doses, some are clear out-of-body experiences, and some have some visuals, although not as much as with LSD or psilocybin, the tryptamines. It's in the category, it's chemically, it's related to phencyclidine, PCP, and people remember that. It is used in veterinary medicine as an anesthetic, hence the idea of horse tranquilizer. Someone from another country who was raised with horses was in a group that I was with, and they said, yeah, it was used as a horse tranquilizer. And they said, that's a horrible thing to say. Horses are so sensitive. How could this be? Anyway, so ketamine's been around, and it was actually, it has a sort of reputation in the psychedelic counterculture as well from the 60s, because it was used by some psychiatrists as a psychedelic agent. Salvador Roquette, notably in Mexico. Anyway, it's back on the scene. It's very safe. And it, when used in lower doses, it does induce an altered state experience that can be used in the same way that other psychedelics are used in therapy. When I was at Stanford, this would have been in the early 80s, I had a friend who was working in pediatric anesthesia, and they were doing research on ketamine, and they had been giving large bolus doses to children, and the children were sort of going out, and the parents were sort of worried about the whole thing. So they were experimenting with a new delivery regimen, which was a smaller loading dose and a continuous infusion. So he called me And he said, would you like to be a normal subject in a in an intravenous ketamine infusion trial? And I said, yeah, it sounds interesting. So they hooked me up to an IV ketamine drip for 3 hours. And I'll tell you, I still remember this vividly. And it was easily 20, more than like 30 years ago. I mean, it was a long time ago. And he turns on the IV infusion. He's dictating an dictaphone, checking my blood pressure and all this. And he ramps it up a little bit. And I say, I'm feeling fine. I feel a little this and that. And then the next thing I know, I'm in the top corner of the room. And I'm looking at him, my friend, playing with the IV. And I'm looking at myself. And I said, wow, if I'm up here, who is that down there? Yeah. And I had this epiphany with that, you know, consciousness survives bodily death. And I don't need a body in order to be conscious, because I'm seeing this and I have no body. And on and on. So, yeah, very powerful.
That's Ram Dass's, you know, psilocybin trip, right?
Really? Really?
You never heard that story?
I don't know that.
Okay, well, you'll have to refer to the Be Here Now Network and go to a podcast where he describes it in the early days. But basically, it's the same thing. Next thing he knew, he's on the ceiling looking down at his body and going, what the heck is that?
Really?
Just described exactly how he described. I mean, you know, he goes into great detail. It's worth listening to. But yeah, that's amazing.
Fascinating.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, okay, so.
Well, anyway, just a quick note on some of this stuff, because people are starting, well, what's this? How is this all coming together? So ketamine is a big deal in the rave scene in music. It's used a lot because you can titrate the dose easily. It's easy to take. You snort it and stuff like that. So it's used in that world quite a lot. And because it's so safe, I think people get along with it. The trouble is that that world, they have a tendency to mix a lot of drugs together, which probably not good.
Whole other thing.
right.
The whole other thing, yeah. Yeah. Well, probably this is a good time in our program to give the little bit of the small print around this, you know, which is do not take this at home on your own, thinking that you can therapize yourself with, you know, set and setting is real. And responsible behavior is real, and we want to say that. Ram Dass used to say that all the time in recent years, just before he left, and the time he was in Maui, about being responsible for it as a spiritual journey that it is best to have someone help guide you through, whether it be reading Rumi poems to you or whatever you like. This is what should happen. So. That's our little, what do they call the small print? In the
I appreciate that. And the small print for me also includes a couple of words that we're talking about these substances because they're remarkable and they have an incredible history and a very interesting potential use as therapy. But I have to remind people, as a physician, I can't recommend them because they're not legal. That is very likely to change for MDMA and psilocybin.
Well, ketamine is still legal, though.
Ketamine is legal, and ketamine, when it is being used in therapy settings, quite actively now. Absolutely.
Yeah,
and it does work. It does seem to have a clear antidepressant effect.
Yeah, I just got someone just recently. I did a podcast with him, actually, a friend of mine who's got a podcast, Mike, and he described a deep, deep depressive journey that he had a couple of years ago. And many, 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 many people are subject to it, especially nowadays with the way our world is. And through ketamine therapy, he said, it absolutely healed me.
That's wonderful.
And this is years ago, you know, at least a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was happy to do that because everybody out there that is, apparently, it's legal and there's a way and there's therapists that know how to create the kind of set and setting that works.
So, right.
Now, can I ask one thing about, because
I
had an experience that many people have all the time. They go to the dentist and they ask for nitrous oxide.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I've done this over the years. I pretty consistently have darshan with this, meaning the divine presence is there, okay?
Right, right.
What is it? I mean, is, you know, this is no different than anything else I might have, you know, imbibed over the years. I mean, most of what I did was fairly well, I could say, responsible. Even, I mean, being with Ram Dass, I didn't take anything and I got there, okay? It was just...
Right.
So, yeah, nitrous, yeah, that was weird to me.
I mean, you know, first of all, what you said, you know, what is that? That's so that's such an interesting question. What is that that you touch into?
Yeah.
And but let me say a couple quick things about nitrous. Nitrous also quite commonly used in medical settings as an anesthetic. It's more an analgesic. It's a painkiller. But you know, laughing gas, and you can makes you happy. Yeah. So kills the pain. But it's actually quite an altered state experience, as you know. Time compression is sort of time dilation. Time just seems to stop with nitrous. But anyway, there are a lot of other features of it.
You hit it. Now I understand. Thank you, Silver.
Yeah.
Because you're just saying in when I, you know, was in India with Neem Karoli Baba, that's what happened.
Really?
Yeah,
yeah.
Time, boom, gone.
Right.
Right. And it's the same thing, you know, and you were in a joyful, I mean, it's not even, the words don't say it, it's pretty ineffable, but still, yeah, that's what happened to me on that nitrous. I had that same darshan. There's only one thing going on, and that's the beauty of all these different possibilities, you know, that you are experimenting and researching with is wonderful.
And those are all features of it, and this has been written about all the way back to the Good Friday experiment of Walter Pankey's work. But it's timelessness, it's connectedness to everything, it's the feeling of love and joy, sort of satchitananda, that sort of feeling. All of that is part of the psychedelic experience. It's a remarkable thing. And that is the question. What is that? You know, what's there that allows you to do that? And I had mentioned to you earlier, I had an experience where I was in that state and I felt this tremendous love. But as I scanned the field, I was just out in the cosmos. I mean, there wasn't anything around me except glittering stars. And there was no people and nothing organic, nothing in the field, yet I was feeling this love. And that is what an empathogenic experience can be like. But for me, I'm used to having that feeling sort of in relationship to another person or something that I can see. And all. But this was completely with nothing in the field. Mm. And I remember asking a friend of mine, I said, what is that? And he said, you know, Ramana Maharshi wrote about that. That's the ground of being. That's the benevolent universe. That's what's there when you strip everything away. And I mentioned that to another Buddhist scholar that I know, and he said, yeah, that's what brings, stripping all that stuff away allows that to come forward. That's your sort of Buddha nature. It's in there. Mm. You're touching into something that's loving, that's benevolent, that's joyful, and that's sort of immense, big, and doesn't have all those things. No time, no, ineffable, can't really describe it, you know, the usual stuff. Yeah. So it's fascinating to say that. It's wonderful to hear the stories, what you said about Ram Dass. Wow.
Yeah. Recently, this is my newest, I'm borrowing stuff from this incredible Rinpoche, but I did a podcast recently with a good old friend of mine, Dan Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence, and he's done a bunch of really incredible books and works with Richie Davidson, who I'm sure you know too.
Right, right, yeah.
So they did Danny did a book with Tsokni Rinpoche. Do you know who that? Have you heard of him?
No, I don't know.
Oh, so he comes from, I mean, it's just nuts. He comes from a family. His father was one of the great Tulku Orgyen Rinpoche.
Oh, right.
Great meditation masters of the last 150 years.
Yeah.
And he had four sons, and they all became, you know, lamas. And Wingyur Rinpoche is one of them, who's this extraordinary story in himself, and Sokni, and I just lost the other brother's name. Two brothers. Anyhow, they wrote this book together, Why We Meditate. This ties in. It ties in so well to what we've been talking about, how wonderful these, how impactful these psychedelic drugs in general. Obviously, they have different properties, and they do a little bit different things. But ultimately, how do we integrate going forward that which is what this is all about, where we see we are part of one family, you know, mm-hmm. and we are interconnected with nature and everything that indigenous wisdom offers us.
Right.
You know, and so he said, there's a... because the ground of being, his way of saying it was essence love. There's something underneath all of the, you know, the waves that happen, which is our lives and going through from the ego, I, and you know, and interacting with all of it through people, through events, through circumstances, and so on. But underneath it, he said, there's an essence love, which again, my rudder for that is being with Neem Karoli Baba, which that's what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said further, so what happens when you contact ground of being, essence love, all one, right? When you connect with that, suddenly there's the breath leaves you, there's a big sigh, shall we say. And it's a sense of okayness, he called it.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Okayness. We are okay.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And, yeah. So it's the ground of being, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, one thing that we kind of need to address, and that's... and you have in this thing you sent me, actually, where somebody was asking a couple of questions, and one of them was around what happens with this psychedelic research and therapy and proving out so many wonderful things. And, of course, but on a day-to-day basis, people are using a lot of it's in ceremony. I've seen, you know, wonderful groups and doing it, and I have good friends who lead them and all that. But... there's a way that you see the attachment to the experience is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And that is causing mm-hmm. other reverberations around, you know, the ingestion and the integration of psychedelics. And what happened, the reference was here, what happened with mindfulness. You and I have actually talked about it,
mm-hmm.
and how mindfulness, you know, without the spiritual form that it came from, which is around loving kindness, which is around, you know, right living, right livelihood, right values, whatever, the Eightfold Path, creates a bit of a monster. And how do you think that's happening, and how to maybe cut through that with psychedelic?
I mean, this is such an important question. There's so much in what you just said. Let me just say a couple of general things.
Yeah.
Meditation, with its origins in Vipassana and Buddhism, is a foundational practice that's aimed at, you know, walking the Eightfold Path or living a spiritual, ethical life, that kind of thing. And that story you've said is that it's often been sort of taken out of that context and seen more as a sort of a tool for relaxation, which is all fine because some people, you know, benefit from that. But it can also be used simply as a tool to sort of be a better corporate salesman or a better sniper in the army or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with it. And so there is a criticism that if meditation is not tied to its foundational principles, it can sort of go awry. The same thing had happened with psychedelics. Psychedelics historically and in indigenous use and traditionally were sacramental substances used in prayer ceremonies, or people were praying to, you know, the nature spirits in a ceremonial calendar, etc. Preparation and integration occurred in a village where people all knew each other, etc., etc. Taken out of that context, lots of things can go wrong, and that's why it's important to sort of think about that. Another corollary is that meditation as a foundational practice, the idea of awareness practices are being foundational to many things in psychology or behavior change, is really important, but probably even more important with psychedelics. People in the psychedelic world say, you know, the rich get richer, the better prepared you are, the more you're going to get out of a psychedelic experience. And meditation is a very good, very good and important kind of preparation for psychedelics. On the issue of attachment, also very, very powerful stuff. Peak experiences in general and psychedelic experiences as a subcategory of peak experiences bond people because they survive something sort of huge. If it's a life-threatening experience, their body, we know this from people that have suffered during wars, you know, they're connected for life if they survive together. Yeah, so peak experiences really bond people, and they also can create attachments. And we know that attachments are great in many ways because they sort of connect us to other people and other things, but they can also be a big problem in that we get very stuck on them. And and when they're not there, we have lots of problems leaving them. And that's in psychology, you know, these are referred to as attachment disorders. And they typically come from early childhood experiences where people are left or feel very vulnerable and are scared and that sort of thing. And so they develop these attachment disorders where their relationships are very often encumbered by very fixed kinds of needing to be with the other person in a certain way, or the other person need, or the flip, which is also the so-called avoidance addict, where someone get close to you and you just run the other way because intimacy is really scary. You can all these kinds of attachment notions.
I love that, though. Attachment disorder. Mm-hmm. There isn't one person on this planet except for a being that's gone beyond polarity and is no longer me and you that doesn't have attachment disorder of one sort or another. You know who, you know, Gabor Mate, you know?
Yeah,
I know wonderful. Gabor. So he was like therapizing me once on a podcast. And just basically, yeah, you had an addiction when you were a kid. You know, if you really think about it, what was it, you know? And what was the defense mechanism, addiction, that you were using to get out of the pain, you know? Mm-hmm. And we all have it. It's unbelievable. An attachment disorder.
I got to remember this because I'm going to tell my psychology and psychiatry friends that it's not so horrible to have an attachment disorder since we all have them.
from
a Buddhist point of view, it is absolutely right. You know, that is one of the teachings. And I sent you this thing that I wrote that I had been thinking about this years back. And I wrote this piece that the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, we could go on and do a whole other podcast on
that.
Let me tell you, Sylvia. And maybe we should one day. Well, this is great, great. I'm so happy that we managed to get together.
Yeah, likewise. I've enjoyed talking with you. It's great. I'd love to continue to catch up. I get a lot out of thinking about what's happening now and connecting it to the prior stories. Really helpful. Those primary experiences are so important to sort of bring back and sift through again.
Thank God we made them through.
New light. Right. One person told me, yeah, it's really nice to talk to you. He was like 80. He says, seems like some of the early parts of my life, which I thought were pretty off out there, seems like it made sense. It was made sense.
Yeah.
So I think there's a coherence to this.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. People want to get in touch with you one way or the other. How to?
Probably the best thing is through the email.
Do you have a site? I can't remember.
I don't have a site set up. Just my Gmail address, which you can put out there. I have to sort of apologize. I get so many emails.
Yeah, let's not do that. We're just going to have to see you. I know what. You've got to put something together in a book.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that and doing some work with some people in the Bay Area here along that line. We're actually starting to collect some of our essays and stuff. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's
especially good reminder. Good. Coming from you and your depth of experience, again, with the foot both in the indigenous world and then all the work that you did to become who you are as a scientist and a doctor, and then this research, and then knowing that these two worlds have got to come together, that's an offering, Silver. I'll buy it.
Great. Well, thanks. I need the encouragement, so that it fits well.
That's part of my job. That's what I do.
Great.
So thank you for being with us today, everybody. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And you have people like Silver mentioned, Jack Kornfield, who's part of the podcast gang. And enjoy. And we'll see you next week.